Hello and welcome to Monocle on Culture. I'm Robert Bound. On today's show, I'm speaking with the revered British artist Maggie Hamling. Since graduating from the Slade School of Art in 1969, the Suffolk-born artist has made a name for herself as both a painter and sculptor. Hamling's depictions of the sea are particularly distinct, expressionistic images that create the dynamism of crashing waves through her physical use of paint. On viewing, we're at peril of being swept away. Hamling's rebellious streak is clear in both her life and her career. Over the years, she's courted controversy through sculptures like that of Oscar Wilde at London's Charing Cross. The granite monument is complete with cigarette in hand, as is she most often. Or more recently, honouring the philosopher and women's rights champion Mary Wollstonecraft with a naked statue of the pioneer. Clearly, Hamling is as quick to deploy a lively wink as she is a withering look. Now, Hamling has a new solo show at Pearl Lam Galleries in Hong Kong. Entitled The Night, the exhibition riffs on that period of time which has been an enduring subject for her and includes two new series of paintings that have never been seen before. I was delighted to be joined here in the studio at Midori House by Maggie Hamling. Like her work, the septuagenarian is full of life. With a strawberry vape clutched in hand, we discussed everything from her very first cigarette to how she approaches teaching her students and the elusive nature of the muse. Stay tuned for Maggie Hamling here on Monocle on Culture. Maggie, thank you very much for joining us today to discuss The Night and other things. The Night is opening at the Pearl Lam Gallery in Hong Kong, and there's some beautiful parts of this show that reflect perhaps part of the world that it's going to sit in first and foremost. What's your first relationship with Chinese drawing, I suppose, I wonder? What were the earliest things you remember?
Going to the British Museum and studying, you know, those scrolls, those long scrolls on silk. And I'm a great believer in the Chinese idea that you've got to be as eloquent where you don't make a mark as where you do make a mark. Mm-hmm. It's quite tricky. And I always left a bit of, even when I filled more of the canvas with paint than I do nowadays, I always left a bit of bare canvas for Samuel Beckett. You know, for Waiting for Godot, yeah. You know, always a bit. But as I got older, I try to say more with less.
It's a rule of thumb, I suppose, right? Does that take a career's worth of painting and knowing what to know what to leave out, I wonder?
Yes, I think it does. I think it does, to get rid of all the unnecessary bits. Mm. I mean, I get up very early in the morning and I make a drawing in my sketchbook with ink with my left hand to renew the sense of touch on the paper each morning. It's like a pianist doing the scales,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And I do use my left hand because it's full of surprises and I don't know quite what it'll do because this hand is full of tricks after all these years, do you know? Boring, boring, boring.
So this kind of does what you think it's going to do a little bit more, and the left one is a law unto itself, at least at that time in the morning.
It is.
And what's that? So, and I've read this and heard this that you have quite a pretty strict ritual regime, whatever it might be. Maybe it's just a little bout of insomnia. I'm with you on the early morning thing. Maybe we just can't help it. And this is at your studio in Suffolk. That must be that moment of, don't want to place a silly word in our mouths, but that moment of communion with the paper, with the canvas, must be... Does that feel fresh every morning?
It feels very fresh every morning. And, of course, it is the best time of day because nobody telephones.
Right.
And the world is one's own. And when... I mean, for 4 or 5 years, I'd get up early in the morning and go and draw the sea. Mm. And there was no one else there. It was fantastic.
There are moments of liquidity and kineticism in this body of work, The Night, and... Obviously, your look at the night sky itself, your works that address the night precisely, or pretty precisely, and I understand that's something that you did, some of your first works when you were a teenager, or certainly at art school, were concerned with the night, fascinated with the night.
It's even earlier than that. When I was 13 at school, and I was drawing, and the art teacher came round and said, why are you drawing? Because all the other girls were painting. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what I said. Anyway, she sort of suggested that I might be colourblind, which I thought was a bit of a cheek. So I did a painting just to show her I wasn't colourblind. And then there was an art exam when I was 14. And I did nothing but flick paint at people and generally draw attention to myself because I was deeply in love with a biology mistress who was invigilating the exam. And then I saw the clock in a bit of terror. It was 3:20. And at 3:30, I knew I had to hand in a painting. So I did one without thinking. Mm-hmm. And then when the results came out 2 or 3 weeks later, I was top of art. So I thought, my God, this is quite interesting. I must look into this business, you know. It seems I'm good at it and I don't even try or something. And so then I stayed up until 2 o'clock in the morning trying to paint the night sky out of my bedroom window. And I took them into school the next day and they were all laid out on these tables. And the art teacher came into the room and I was sort of standing in the corner and on the point of tears. And she said, came up to me and said, what's the matter? And I said, well, I was up until 2 o'clock in the morning trying to paint the night sky out of my bedroom window and everyone's laughing at them. And so she said to me, it just must be water off a duck's back. Don't take a blind bit of notice of whatever anyone says about your work. You're your own best critic and just must be water off a duck's back. So I was very lucky to have that said to me at the age of 14.
So that's been like the words through the Hambling stick of rock, something yes. like that, the family motto. And the night is, obviously, it's a place, it's a place of madness, it's a place of romance, it's a place of carnal desire as well. These seem to be addressed in these new works that yes. that are going on display in Hong Kong. To you, is it all those things? Was it all those things from those first, you said you had a crush on the, or you were in love with the biology mistress. Is there a through line to this collection from those days?
For that exam, there were three subjects and I chose the subject of laziness. And I painted a woman lying on a chaise longue with a half open book. In other words, she was too lazy even to read the book. So it was the night sky came after that. But, it's a sort of universal place. Whether we're in China or whether we're in London, there is the night sky. It's a mysterious sort of realm where dream meets reality and where sex meets mythology and the unknown meets the known. And it's a strange place.
And I guess the Hong Kong skyline and the Suffolk skyline from where it was realised are fairly different places. There's a few more sparkly towers on the Hong Kong skyline than the Suffolk one. Aldborough isn't that popular yet, is it?
No, thank God.
Do you think about for this new show, do you think about where it'll end up? Do you think about where it first opens and where those paintings therefore might be bought and sold and distributed, or do you start each collection with the same sort of thought in your mind? Does it matter where they end up, I wonder?
No, it doesn't really. Because painting sells, but I'm into the thrills and spills of horror of the next one.
Already,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
And I had two shows in China, one in Beijing and one in Guangzhou. In 2019, and it was quite extraordinary. They are, everybody has very straight, very black hair, and I know we're on the radio, but
Maggie's very Googleable, listeners, and not does not look, yes.
Well, I have this sort of chaotic, curly, whitish hair, and so they couldn't believe my hair, and so they called me Einstein. which is quite nice, really.
That's good. I'd take Einstein. Were you filling many a locket with a strand of hair?
Well, I don't know. I
had leaving destruction in your way.
A thousand selfies, and the last selfie I did was with a teddy bear. I thought, fucking hell, I don't know what I've come to now, having to do a selfie with a teddy bear. But I think the teddy bear was also quite curly.
Oh, right. OK. So it's a compare and contrast.
Yes.
How the mighty fall, Maggie Hampley. And Pearl, this is for Pearl Lamb's gallery. Pearl is quite a force of nature as well.
She certainly is.
I feel like this is a meeting of minds, a clash of the titans, possibly.
Both quite short, but both quite strong.
Punchy. So, yeah, what about your relationship with Pearl? And well, we'll start with Pearl, and then by extension, the art world in inverted commas. Selling the stuff is different to making it, as you pointed out, but it's nice to have friends in your corner, isn't it?
Yes, well, Pearl came to Suffolk and saw the studio in Suffolk, and she's very perceptive and quite frightening.
She's got a great look as well.
Yes, indeed. And I think we're quite a match for each other, possibly. And she certainly knows her stuff. And she's fascinating to look at.
Yeah. I feel like she almost could be one of those people she's one of those people that could have hung out with Bacon and some of those sort of colony room buddies, possibly.
Maybe.
You might have had to put a coaster under her drink, but nonetheless, yeah.
Very common coasters.
Well, you're in Studio One here, and we're freestyling with the coffee. And the elements that run through this collection, Maggie, the night, as I say, there are things that remind me of water, things that are intimate things that are called sexy, for example. When these things are not named accidentally, so are these things, do these things, when you start then that sort of morning ritual, the left hand sketching, and then the right hand, that all too wise right hand painting the painting in the end, does the thing end up being the thing that you started?
You know, I begin a painting. I mean, it's very easy to begin a painting. It's very difficult to finish one. But I don't know what I certainly don't have any clue what it's going to look like when it's finished. I mean, everything must be an experiment. I know that word is overused, but you know, you can't churn paintings out because they just become mannered and dead. You know, everything, the tiniest piece of paper that you address yourself to is a space on which you're making a drawing. I mean, you use the word sketch. I won't let any of my students use the word sketch because it implies something that's not important, you know, and casual and all that. But, you know, the tiniest piece of paper, you are addressing yourself to that bit of space. And the best times in the studio, and I call, you know, the time in the studio is real time for me. And I leave the studio, well, it's just the rest. It's just the rest of time, you know. But the real time is being on my own, full of doom and gloom and doubt and trying to make something. And so when the muse is with me, the painting paints itself, you know, and I can do everything every day to try and get the muse to arrive, but she's very awkward. She doesn't choose to arrive every day, you
Indeed.
Know. And sometimes I can spend two or three or four months on a painting and then get rid of it. But then I can make that painting in a morning or in three quarters of an hour or something, but I couldn't do it unless I produced all the shit for several months beforehand.
Yeah, it must take some guts, albeit with your experience, some guts to throw away something you've been working with, struggling with, fighting slightly, does it?
Well, paintings come alive and die and come alive and die. And if it finally kicks the bucket, it's got to go.
But then when it works, as Einstein would have said, it's a you. Sorry.
Yes.
Eureka
when it
works. Moment.
It's a fantastic feeling, unlike anything else, better than anything, yes.
And you mentioned your students. that must be a lovely thing. I mean, I know that you were at the Slade, Camberwell, yourself. What about that? Are there any through lines on how you were taught and how you teach yourself? Or do you, are you a doer and they are followers? What's the style of your teaching? Or was it difficult to kind of know when you're in the midst of it yourself?
Well, when I was 15, I went to it was known as the Artist's House on the edge of Hadley, where I grew up in Suffolk, where there were Cedric Morris and Lett Haynes. And I realised pretty early on that the Cedric people just tried to paint like Cedric, which I saw no point in at all. But Lett was the most extraordinary teacher in that he would address himself to a new person and try and bring out who they were, you know, their personal vision. And that's how I try to teach. And I mean, Lett was a very great teacher. He's the one who said to me, if you're going to be an artist, you've got to make your work your best friend, that you can go to it whatever you're feeling. You're feeling tired, you're feeling happy, you're feeling bored, you're feeling randy, whatever you're feeling, go to it and have a conversation with it, which is how I've lived my life. And so that's how I try to teach and to bring everybody. I mean, I only have a life class once a week, but try to bring out the personal vision or the personal use of paint of each of the students. Yeah. So there's no house style.
And does that, that's good. Can you see your students being emboldened by your attitude, by that, by you instilling in the similar things that Lett instilled in you or that you witnessed there at Hadley?
Well, yes, and have produced one or two, like Cecily Brown, if you've heard.
Yeah, no slouch.
Should have asked for 10%. Anyway.
So, yes, she worked for you. She worked for you, and she was a student, didn't she?
Yes, she was a student, and I had a garage that I let her use as a studio in exchange for which she was my cleaner. This is a few years ago, yeah.
Well, that's water under the bridge. I'm sure that, but I know a great friendship blossomed from that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very fond of each other.
Yeah.
And when I had the heart attack in New York, I mean, I was at her house as we'd installed the show.
You were at the New York's Marlborough Gallery.
Yes. So we'd installed the show on the Monday, and then she came later in the day on the Tuesday to see the show. And we all got in a taxi and went back to her house for supper. And I just had some whiskey. And suddenly everything went blank. And Hugh, who works with me, looked across the room and said, something's happened to Maggie. But luckily, it was in New York and the ambulance came straight away.
Right.
And I was 6 weeks in Mount Sinai Hospital.
Right.
So it was all fine. I mean, if it had happened in Suffolk, I would still be waiting for the ambulance.
As we speak. Yeah, you might have seen the cavalry first, I think, sadly. But you're sprightly, Maggie. We should point out that the cigarette of former years has been replaced by a pink vape.
Yes.
Fetching pink vape. But we all have crosses to bear. We all have crosses to bear.
Yes, I'm afraid the heart attack did do in the cigarettes. You see, cigarettes came into my life when I decided that I was going to try and be an artist, and my mother paid for me to stay in Suffolk with the art teacher, and it was very hot, and she wandered across a couple of fields to see what I was doing, and insects were sticking to the paints, they were sticking to the palette, they were sticking to the painting, they were sticking to the rag. And I said, what can I do? And she said, well, there's only one thing to do, have a cigarette. So from the minute of having oil paint in my hands, I had a cigarette.
Smoke them out.
So it was very difficult.
Yeah, indeed. it's a tough thing to break. People kind of associate that, to broaden it out away from the art. People always hold you up as a scion of bohemianism. And you had a great time with Francis Bacon and many people in the art milieu of former days. That can't be a bad thing. I know you rolled your eyes, listeners. But people love that kind of thing. Do you see that glint in the eye of your students,
well,
of Cecily, of the rest? If you're the best, what about the rest, Maggie?
Well, you see, what was great about the colony was that the people could be as rude as they possibly could be to each other, and they'd just meet the next day, and it was as if none of it had happened, and then they'd do it again. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? We're now all sort of rather curbed in what we'd have to say, aren't we?
Yeah.
And there are wonderful stories of, like, there was a young man who waited outside the colony every night for Francis Bacon to come out, and eventually Bacon came out, and the young man stepped forward and said, "I'm an artist, will you come and see my paintings?" And Bacon said, "Your paintings are dreadful." So the young man said, "Well, you haven't seen them." And he said, "I've seen your tie."
Yeah, right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. Was that a young man in search of it? I know that I've heard you talk about your lack of patience with isms and ists and things like this. They are... In the art world is in the grip of many isms and ists and things that always have to be doing a moral job rather than just an artistic job. I didn't want to lose the opportunity to ask you what you think of that in the, you know, with this current The Night work that you're doing, where it'll be displayed, all the rest of it. I wondered what your views were on that, on the isms and the ists.
Well, I've always refused to be an ist. I mean, I suppose I'm an artist, so...
That works.
But the people like to put you in a box, you know, an expressionist or an impressionist or a conceptualist or a portraitist or some bloody kind of ist. And when you're put in a box, it's all sort of safe and they can refer to the box that you're in.
It's a coffin. Well, every box is kind of a coffin, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I've always refused. And... Well, some of my public sculpture has been a bit controversial.
Good for you. Come on.
The most recent one of Mary Wollstonecraft in London.
Yeah. This is up at Newington Green.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, there was a lot of fuss.
She's a silver fox. She's a vixen.
There was a lot of fuss about it. And my friend, the writer Paul Bailey, who always watches the Channel 4 news, rang me immediately after 8 o'clock on that Tuesday when Mary sort of hit the world.
When she was unveiled.
When she was unveiled. And said, "Well, you have put the pussy among the pigeons this time. Never mind scallop."
Yeah.
And that same week, I was leaving Waitrose in near where I live in Suffolk, and with a trolley full of stuff, and one of the lovely Suffolk ladies gave me a big grin and said, "Been making trouble again, I see."
See, these are badges of honour, aren't they, Maggie?
Yes, of course they are.
I always ruffle the hair of Oscar on my way. I live, I get to go to Charing Cross every evening, and I ruffle Oscar's hair on the way home every night.
Yes.
He's very handsome, lying there in state. Yeah.
Well, it's very important to me that he wasn't up on a pillar,
yeah,
do you know, being a sort of foppish kind of dandy or something. Because he was a great humanitarian, and I wanted him down on the street so people could sit and have a cigarette with him. And
a conversation piece, a proper conversation piece. And some of your public works Well, it hasn't made people scratch their heads. Quite the opposite. People jump to assumptions. But I can see there's just an impish pleasure that you take in pissing people off in this way. Then people's wisdom and ignorance is both impostors.
I don't set out to be controversial.
No.
I mean, when scallop was put on Aldbury Beach and there was such a fuss about it and it got graffiti on it 13 times, when it all began, I was rather hurt because I thought it was one of the more beautiful things I'd managed to do. But, I mean, now, of course, the people who are so against it, I mean, they'd realise how much ice cream and fish and chips right. get sold on the back of it. And I think they'd be quite cross if it was taken away.
Someone removed it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. What? But, you see, about criticism, the actor Donald Wolfit got it right when... And he got a good review. He'd say, written by a very intelligent person. And when he got a bad review, he said, written by one of my enemies.
We'll take that and run with it. For the time being, congratulations on The Night, Pearl Am Galleries in Hong Kong. And thank you very much for allowing us to stray further than that, indeed. Thanks, Maggie Hammond.
Thank you. Thank you.
And that is all for this week. My thanks to Maggie Hambling. Her exhibition, The Night, is on at Pearl Am Galleries in Hong Kong until the 16th of May. Monocle on Culture is produced by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Steph Chungu. We'll be back at the same time next week. But until then, from me, Robert Bound, thanks for tuning in.